credulity as to unseen things, but inability to construct a system as to seen things. Another aspect of this difficulty, which Gibb was later to blame for the absence of form in Arabic literature and for the Muslims' essentially atomistic view of reality, is that the difference in the Oriental is not essentially religiosity, but the lack of the sense of law. For him, there is no immovable order of nature. If such a fact seems not to account for the extraordinary achievements of Islamic science, upon which a great deal in modern Western science is based, then MacDonald remains silent. He continues his catalogue. It is evident that anything is possible to the Oriental. The supernatural is so near that it may touch him at any moment. That an occasion, namely the historical and geographical birth of monotheism in the Orient, should, in MacDonald's argument, become an entire theory of difference between East and West, signifies the degree of intensity to which Orientalism has committed MacDonald. Here is his summary. Inability, then, to see life steadily and see it whole, to understand that a theory of life must cover all the facts, and liability to be stampeded by a single idea and blinded to everything else, therein, I believe, is the difference between the East and the West. None of this, of course, is particularly new. From Schlegel to Renan, from Robertson Smith to T.E. Lawrence, these ideas get repeated and re-repeated. They represent a decision about the Orient, not by any means a fact of nature. Anyone who, like MacDonald and Gibb, consciously entered a profession called Orientalism, did so on the basis of a decision made. That the Orient was the Orient, that it was different, and so forth. The elaborations, refinements, consequent articulations of the field, therefore sustain and prolong the decision to confine the Orient. There is no perceivable irony in MacDonald's or Gibb's views about Oriental liability to be stampeded by a single idea. Neither man seems able to recognize the extent of Orientalism's liability to be stampeded by the single idea of Oriental difference. And neither man is concerned by such wholesale designations as Islam or the Orient being used as proper nouns, with adjectives attached and verbs streaming forth as if they referred to persons and not to Platonic ideas. It is no accident, therefore, that Gibb's master theme, in almost everything he wrote about Islam and the Arabs, was the tension between Islam as a transcendent, compelling Oriental fact and the realities of everyday human experience. His investment as a scholar and as a devout Christian was in Islam, not so much in the, to him, relatively trivial complications introduced into Islam by nationalism, class struggle, the individualizing experiences of love, anger, or human work. Nowhere is the impoverishing character of this investment more evident than in Whither Islam, a volume edited and contributed to, in the title essay, by Gibb in 1932. It also includes an impressive article on North African Islam by Massignon. Gibb's task, as he saw it, was to assess Islam, its present situation, its possible future course. In such a task, the individual and manifestly different regions of the Islamic world were to be not refutations of Islam's unity, but examples of it. Gibb himself proposed an introductory definition of Islam. Then, in the concluding essay, he sought to pronounce on its actuality and its real future. Like MacDonald, Gibb seems entirely comfortable with the idea of a monolithic East, whose existential circumstances cannot easily be reduced to race or racial theory. In resolutely denying the value of racial generalization, Gibb rises above what had been most reprehensible in preceding generations of Orientalists. Gibb has a correspondingly generous and sympathetic view of Islam's universalism and tolerance in letting diverse ethnic and religious communities coexist peacefully and democratically within its imperium. There is a note of grim prophecy in Gibb's singling out the Zionists and the Maronite Christians, alone amongst ethnic communities in the Islamic world, for their inability to accept coexistence. But the heart of Gibb's argument is that Islam, perhaps because it finally represents the Oriental's exclusive concern not with nature, but with the unseen, has an ultimate precedence and domination over all life in the Islamic Orient. For Gibb, Islam is Islamic orthodoxy, is also the community of believers, is life, unity, intelligibility, values. It is law and order, too, the unsavory disruptions of jihadists and communist agitators notwithstanding. In page after page of Gibb's prose in Whither Islam, we learn that the new commercial banks in Egypt and Syria are facts of Islam or an Islamic initiative. Schools and an increasing literacy rate are Islamic facts, too, as are journalism, Westernization, and intellectual societies. At no point does Gibb speak of European colonialism when he discusses the rise of nationalism and its toxins. That the history of modern Islam might be more intelligible for its resistance, political and non-political, to colonialism never occurs to Gibb, just as it seems to him finally irrelevant to note whether the Islamic governments he discusses are republican, feudal, or monarchical. Islam, for Gibb, is a sort of superstructure imperiled both by politics, nationalism, communist agitation, westernization, and by dangerous Muslim attempts to tamper with its intellectual sovereignty. In the passage that follows, note how the word religion and its cognates are made to color the tone of Gibb's prose, so much so that we feel a decorous annoyance at the mundane pressures directed at Islam. Islam, as a religion, has lost little of its force, but Islam as the arbiter of social life in the modern world is being dethroned. Alongside it, or above it, new forces exert an authority which is sometimes in contradiction to its traditions and its social prescriptions, but nevertheless forces its way in their teeth. To put the position in its simplest terms, what has happened is this. Until recently, the ordinary Muslim citizen and cultivator had no political interests or functions, and no literature of easy access except religious literature. Had no festivals and no communal life except in connection with religion, saw little or nothing of the outside world except through religious glasses. To him, in consequence, religion meant everything. Now, however, more in all the advanced countries, his interests have expanded and his activities are no longer bounded by religion. He has political questions thrust on his notice. He reads, or has read to him, a mass of articles on subjects of all kinds which have nothing to do with religion, and in which the religious point of view may not be discussed at all, and the verdict held to lie with some quite different principles. Admittedly, the picture is a little difficult to see, since, unlike any other religion, Islam is or means everything. As a description of a human phenomenon, the hyperbole is, I think, unique to Orientalism. Life itself, politics, literature, energy, activity, growth, is an intrusion upon this, to a Westerner, unimaginable Oriental totality. Yet, as a complement and counterbalance to European civilization, Islam in its modern form is nevertheless a useful object. This is the core of Gibb's proposition about modern Islam. For, in the broadest aspect of history, what is now happening between Europe and Islam is the reintegration of Western civilization, artificially sundered at the Renaissance and now reasserting its unity with overwhelming force. Unlike Massignon, who made no effort to conceal his metaphysical speculations, Gibb delivered such observations as this as if they were objective knowledge, a category he found wanting in Massignon. Yet, by almost any standards, most of Gibb's general works on Islam are metaphysical, not only because he uses abstractions like Islam as if they have a clear and distinct meaning, but also because it is simply never clear where in concrete time and space Gibb's Islam is taking place. If, on the one hand, following MacDonald, he puts Islam definitively outside the West, on the other hand, in much of his work he is to be found reintegrating it with the West. In 1955, he made this inside-outside question a bit clearer. The West took from Islam only those non-scientific elements that it had originally derived from the West, whereas in borrowing much from Islamic science, the West was merely following the law making natural science and technology indefinitely transmissible. The net result is to make Islam, in art, aesthetics, philosophy, and religious thought, a second-order phenomenon, since those came from the West, and so far as science and technology are concerned, a mere conduit for elements that are not sui generis Islamic. Any clarity about what Islam is in Gibb's thought ought to be found within these metaphysical constraints, and indeed his two important works of the 40s, Modern Trends in Islam and Mohammedanism, an Historical Survey, flesh out matters considerably. In both books, Gibb is at great pains to discuss the present crisis in Islam, opposing its inherent essential being to modern attempts at modifying it. I have already mentioned Gibb's hostility to modernizing currents in Islam and his stubborn commitment to Islamic orthodoxy. Now it is time to mention Gibb's preference for the word Mohammedanism over Islam, since he says that Islam is really based upon an idea of apostolic succession culminating in Muhammad, and his assertion that the Islamic master science is law, which early on replaced theology. The curious thing about these statements is that they are assertions made about Islam, not on the basis of evidence internal to Islam, but rather on the basis of a logic deliberately outside Islam. No Muslim would call himself a Mohammedan, nor, so far as is known, would he necessarily feel the importance of law over theology. But what Gibb does is to situate himself as a scholar within contradictions he himself discerns, at that point in Islam where there is a certain unexpressed dislocation between the formal outward process and the inner realities. The Orientalist, then, sees his task as expressing the dislocation and consequently speaking the truth about Islam, which, by definition, since its contradictions inhibit its powers of self-discernment, it cannot express. Most of Gibb's general statements about Islam supply concepts to Islam that the religion or culture, again, by his definition, is incapable of grasping. Oriental philosophy had never appreciated the fundamental idea of justice in Greek philosophy. As for Oriental societies, in contrast to most Western societies, they have generally devoted themselves to building stable social organizations more than to constructing ideal systems of philosophical thought. The principal internal weakness of Islam is the breaking of association between the religious orders and the Muslim upper and middle classes. But Gibb is also aware that Islam has never remained isolated from the rest of the world and therefore must stand in a series of external dislocations, insufficiencies, and disjunctions between itself and the world. Thus, he says that modern Islam is the result of a classical religion coming into disynchronous contact with romantic Western ideas. In reaction to this assault, Islam developed a school of modernists whose ideas everywhere reveal hopelessness, ideas unsuited to the modern world. Mahdism, nationalism, a revived caliphate. Yet the conservative reaction to modernism is no less unsuited to modernity, for it has produced a kind of stubborn Luddism. Well, then, we ask, what is Islam finally, if it cannot conquer its internal dislocations nor deal satisfactorily with its external surroundings? The answer can be sought in the following central passage from Modern Trends. Islam is a living and vital religion, appealing to the hearts, minds, and consciences of tens and hundreds of millions, setting them a standard by which to live honest, sober, and God-fearing lives. It is not Islam that is petrified, but its orthodox formulations, its systematic theology, its social apologetic. It is here that the dislocation lies, that the dissatisfaction is felt among a large proportion of its most educated and intelligent adherents, and that the danger for the future is most evident. No religion can ultimately resist disintegration if there is a perpetual gulf between its demands upon the will and its appeal to the intellect of its followers. That for the vast majority of Muslims the problem of dislocation has not yet arisen justifies the ulama in refusing to be rushed into the hasty measures which the modernists prescribe. But the spread of modernism is a warning that reformulation cannot be indefinitely shelved. In trying to determine the origins and causes of this petrifaction of the formulas of Islam, we may possibly also find a clue to the answer to the question which the modernists are asking, but have so far failed to resolve. The question, that is, of the way in which the fundamental principles of Islam may be reformulated without affecting their essential elements. The last part of this passage is familiar enough. It suggests the now traditional Orientalist ability to reconstruct and reformulate the Orient, given the Orient's inability to do so for itself. In part, then, Gibbs' Islam exists ahead of Islam as it is practiced, studied, or preached in the Orient. Yet this prospective Islam is no mere Orientalist fiction spun out of his ideas. It is based on an Islam that, since it cannot truly exist, appeals to a whole community of believers. The reason that Islam can exist in some more or less future Orientalist formulation of it is that in the Orient, Islam is usurped and traduced by the language of its clergy, whose claim is upon the community's mind. So long as it is silent in its appeal, Islam is safe. The moment the reforming clergy takes on its legitimate role of reformulating Islam in order for it to be able to enter modernity, the trouble starts. And that trouble, of course, is dislocation. Dislocation in Gibbs' work identifies something far more significant than a putative intellectual difficulty within Islam. It identifies, I think, the very privilege, the very ground on which the Orientalist places himself so as to write about, legislate for, and reformulate Islam. Far from being a chance discernment of Gibbs, dislocation is the epistemological passageway into his subject, and subsequently the observation platform from which in all his writing and in every one of the influential positions he filled, he could survey Islam. Between the silent appeal of Islam to a monolithic community of orthodox believers and a whole, merely verbal articulation of Islam by misled cores of political activists, desperate clerks, and opportunistic reformers, there Gibbs stood, wrote, reformulated. His writing said either what Islam could not say or what its clerics would not say. What Gibbs wrote was, in one sense, temporally ahead of Islam in that he allowed that at some point in the future, Islam would be able to say what it could not say now. In another important sense, however, Gibbs' writings on Islam predated the religion as a coherent body of living beliefs, since his writing was able to get hold of Islam as a silent appeal made to Muslims before their faith became a matter for worldly argument, practice, or debate. The contradiction in Gibbs' work, for it is a contradiction to speak of Islam as neither what its clerical adherents in fact say it is, nor what, if they could, its lay followers would say about it, is muted somewhat by the metaphysical attitude governing his work, and indeed governing the whole history of modern Orientalism which he inherited through mentors like MacDonald. The Orient and Islam have a kind of extra-real, phenomenologically reduced status that puts them out of reach of everyone except the Western expert. From the beginning of Western speculation about the Orient, the one thing the Orient could not do was to represent itself. Evidence of the Orient was credible only after it had passed through and been made firm by the refining fire of the Orientalists' work. Gibbs' oeuvre purports to be Islam, or Mohammedanism, both as it is and as it might be. Metaphysically, and only metaphysically, essence and potential are made one. Only a metaphysical attitude could produce such famous Gibb essays as The Structure of Religious Thought in Islam, or An Interpretation of Islamic History, without being troubled by the distinction made between objective and subjective knowledge in Gibbs' criticism of Massignon. The statements about Islam are made with a confidence and a serenity that are truly Olympian. There is no dislocation, no felt discontinuity between Gibbs' page and the phenomenon it describes, for each, according to Gibb himself, is ultimately reducible to the other. As such, Islam and Gibbs' description of it have a calm, discursive plainness whose common element is the English scholar's orderly page. I attach a great deal of significance to the appearance of and to the intended model for the Orientalist's page as a printed object. I have spoken in this book about D'Herbelot's alphabetic encyclopedia, the gigantic leaves of the Description de l'Égypte, Renan's laboratory museum notebook, the ellipses and short episodes of Lane's Modern Egyptians, Sassi's anthological excerpts, and so forth. These pages are signs of some Orient, and of some Orientalist, presented to the reader. There is an order to these pages by which the reader apprehends not only the Orient, but also the Orientalist, as interpreter, exhibitor, personality, mediator, representative, and representing expert. In a remarkable way, Gibb and Massignon produced pages that recapitulate the history of Orientalist writing in the West as that history has been embodied in a varied generic and topographical style, reduced finally to a scholarly, monographic uniformity. The Oriental specimen, the Oriental excess, the Oriental lexicographic unit, the Oriental series, the Oriental exemplum, all these have been subordinated in Gibb and Massignon to the linear prose authority of discursive analysis, presented in essay, short article, scholarly book. In their time, from the end of World War I till the early 60s, three principal forms of Orientalist writing were radically transformed: the encyclopedia, the anthology, the personal record. Their authority was redistributed or dispersed or dissipated to a committee of experts, the Encyclopedia of Islam, the Cambridge History of Islam, to a lower order of service, elementary instruction in language, which would prepare one not for diplomacy, as was the case with Sassi's Chrestomathie, but for the study of sociology, economics, or history. To the realm of sensational revelation, having more to do with personalities or governments, Lawrence is the obvious example, than with knowledge. Gibb, with his quietly heedless but profoundly sequential prose. Massignon, with the flair of an artist for whom no reference is too extravagant so long as it is governed by an eccentric interpretative gift. The two scholars took the essentially ecumenical authority of European Orientalism as far as it could go. After them, the new reality, the new specialized style, was, broadly speaking, Anglo-American. And more narrowly speaking, it was American social scientese. In it, the old Orientalism was broken into many parts, yet all of them still served the traditional Orientalist dogmas. 4. The latest phase. Since World War II, and more noticeably after each of the Arab-Israeli wars, the Arab Muslim has become a figure in American popular culture, even as in the academic world, in the policy planner's world, and in the world of business, very serious attention is being paid the Arab. This symbolizes a major change in the international configuration of forces. France and Britain no longer occupy center stage in world politics. The American imperium has displaced them. A vast web of interests now links all parts of the former colonial world to the United States, just as a proliferation of academic subspecialties divides and yet connects all the former philological and European-based disciplines like Orientalism. The area specialist, as he is now called, lays claim to regional expertise, which is put at the service of government or business or both. The massive, quasi-material knowledge stored in the annals of modern European Orientalism, as recorded, for example, in Jules Moll's 19th-century logbook of the field, has been dissolved and released into new forms. A wide variety of hybrid representations of the Orient now roam the culture. Japan, Indochina, China, India, Pakistan. Their representations have had and continue to have wide repercussions, and they have been discussed in many places for obvious reasons. Islam and the Arabs have their own representations, too, and we shall treat them here as they occur in that fragmentary, yet powerfully and ideologically coherent, persistence, a far less frequently discussed one, into which, in the United States, traditional European Orientalism dispersed itself. 1. Popular images and social science representations. Here are a few examples of how the Arab is often represented today. Note how readily the Arab seems to accommodate the transformations and reductions, all of a simply tendentious kind, into which he is continually being forced. The costume for Princeton's 10th reunion class in 1967 had been planned before the June War. The motif, for it would be wrong to describe the costume as more than crudely suggestive, was to have been Arab, robes, headgear, sandals. Immediately after the war, when it had become clear that the Arab motif was an embarrassment, a change in the reunion plans was decreed. Wearing the costume as had been originally planned, the class was now to walk in procession, hands above heads in a gesture of abject defeat. This was what the Arab had become. From a faintly outlined stereotype as a camel-riding nomad to an accepted caricature as the embodiment of incompetence and easy defeat, that was all the scope given the Arab. Yet after the 1973 war, the Arab appeared everywhere as something more menacing. Cartoons depicting an Arab sheikh standing behind a gasoline pump turned up consistently. These Arabs, however, were clearly Semitic. Their sharply hooked noses, the evil mustachioed leer on their faces, were obvious reminders to a largely non-Semitic population that Semites were at the bottom of all our troubles, which in this case was principally a gasoline shortage. The transference of a popular anti-Semitic animus from a Jewish to an Arab target was made smoothly, since the figure was essentially the same. Thus, if the Arab occupies space enough for attention, it is as a negative value. He is seen as the disruptor of Israel's and the West's existence, or, in another view of the same thing, as a surmountable obstacle to Israel's creation in 1948. Insofar as this Arab has any history, it is part of the history given him, or taken from him, the difference is slight, by the Orientalist tradition, and later the Zionist tradition. Palestine was seen, by Lamartine and the early Zionists, as an empty desert waiting to burst into bloom. Such inhabitants as it had were supposed to be inconsequential nomads, possessing no real claim on the land, and therefore no cultural or national reality. Thus, the Arab is conceived of now as a shadow that dogs the Jew. In that shadow, because Arabs and Jews are Oriental Semites, can be placed whatever traditional, latent mistrust a Westerner feels toward the Oriental. For the Jew of pre-Nazi Europe has bifurcated. What we have now is a Jewish hero, constructed out of a reconstructed cult of the adventurer pioneer Orientalist, Burton, Lane, Renan, and his creeping, mysteriously fearsome shadow, the Arab Oriental. Isolated from everything except the past created for him by Orientalist polemic, the Arab is chained to a destiny that fixes him and dooms him to a series of reactions, periodically chastised by what Barbara Tuchman gives the theological name, Israel's terrible swift sword. Aside from his anti-Zionism, the Arab is an oil supplier. This is another negative characteristic, since most accounts of Arab oil equate the oil boycott of 1973 to 1974, which principally benefited Western oil companies and a small, ruling Arab elite, with the absence of any Arab moral qualifications for owning such vast oil reserves. Without the usual euphemisms, the question most often being asked is why such people as the Arabs are entitled to keep the developed, free, democratic, moral world threatened. From such questions comes the frequent suggestion that the Arab oil fields be invaded by the Marines. In the films and television, the Arab is associated either with lechery or bloodthirsty dishonesty. He appears as an oversexed degenerate, capable, it is true, of cleverly devious intrigues, but essentially sadistic, treacherous, low. Slave trader, camel driver, money changer, colorful scoundrel. These are some traditional Arab roles in the cinema. The Arab leader, of marauders, pirates, native insurgents, can often be seen snarling at the captured Western hero and the blonde girl, both of them steeped in wholesomeness. "My men are going to kill you, but they like to amuse themselves before." He leers suggestively as he speaks. This is a current debasement of Valentino's chic. In newsreels or news photos, the Arab is always shown in large numbers. No individuality, no personal characteristics or experiences. Most of the pictures represent mass rage and misery, or irrational, hence hopelessly eccentric, gestures. Lurking behind all of these images is the menace of jihad. Consequence, a fear that the Muslims or Arabs will take over the world. Books and articles are regularly published on Islam and the Arabs that represent absolutely no change over the virulent anti-Islamic polemics of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. For no other ethnic or religious group is it true that virtually anything can be written or said about it without challenge or demurral. The 1975 course guide put out by the Columbia College undergraduates said about the Arabic course that every other word in the language had to do with violence, and that the Arab mind, as reflected in the language, was unremittingly bombastic. A recent article by Emmett Tyrrell in Harper's Magazine was even more slanderous and racist, arguing that Arabs are basically murderers and that violence and deceit are carried in the Arab genes. A survey entitled The Arabs in American Textbooks reveals the most astonishing misinformation, or rather, the most callous representations of an ethnic religious group. One book asserts that few people of this Arab area even know that there is a better way to live, and then goes on to ask disarmingly, what links the people of the Middle East together? The answer, given unhesitatingly, is, the last link is the Arabs' hostility, hatred, toward the Jews and the nation of Israel. Along with such material goes this about Islam in another book. The Muslim religion, called Islam, began in the 7th century. It was started by a wealthy businessman of Arabia called Muhammad. He claimed that he was a prophet. He found followers among other Arabs. He told them that they were picked to rule the world. This bit of knowledge is followed by another equally accurate. Shortly after Muhammad's death, his teachings were recorded in a book called the Quran. It became the holy book of Islam. These crude ideas are supported, not contradicted, by the academic whose business is the study of the Arab Near East. It is worth noting, incidentally, that the Princeton event I referred to above took place in a university that prides itself on its Department of Near Eastern Studies, founded in 1927, the oldest such department in the country. Take, as an instance, the report produced in 1967 by Mauro Berger, a professor of sociology and Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, at the behest of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. He was then president of the Middle East Studies Association, MESA, the professional association of scholars concerned with all aspects of the Near East, primarily since the rise of Islam and from the viewpoint of the social science and humanistic disciplines, and founded in 1967. He called his paper Middle Eastern and North African Studies, Developments and Needs, and had it published in the second issue of the MESA Bulletin. After surveying the strategic, economic, and political importance of the region to the United States, and after endorsing the various United States government and private foundation projects to support programs in universities, the National Defense Education Act of 1958, a directly Sputnik-inspired initiative, the establishing of links between the Social Science Research Council and Middle Eastern Studies, and so on, Berger came to the following conclusions. The modern Middle East and North Africa is not a center of great cultural achievement, nor is it likely to become one in the near future. The study of the region or its languages, therefore, does not constitute its own reward so far as modern culture is concerned. Our region is not a center of great political power, nor does it have the potential to become one. The Middle East, less so North Africa, has been receding in immediate political importance to the U.S., and even in headline or nuisance value relative to Africa, Latin America, and the Far East. The contemporary Middle East, thus, has only in small degree the kinds of traits that seem to be important in attracting scholarly attention. This does not diminish the validity and intellectual value of studying the area, or affect the quality of work scholars do on it. It does, however, put limits, of which we should be aware, on the field's capacity for growth in the numbers who study and teach. As a prophecy, of course, this is fairly lamentable. What makes it even more unfortunate is that Berger was commissioned not only because he was an expert on the modern Near East, but also, as is clear from the report's conclusion, because he was expected to be in a good position to predict its future and the future of policy. His failure to see that the Middle East was of great political significance and potentially of great political power was no chance aberration of judgment, I think. Both of Berger's main mistakes derive from the first and last paragraphs, whose genealogy is the history of Orientalism as we have been studying it. In what Berger has to say about the absence of great cultural achievement, and in what he concludes about future study, that the Middle East does not attract scholarly attention because of its intrinsic weaknesses, we have an almost exact duplication of the canonical Orientalist opinion that the Semites never produced a great culture, and that, as Renan frequently said, the Semitic world was too impoverished ever to attract universal attention. Moreover, in making such time-honored judgments and in being totally blind to what is before his eyes, after all, Berger was not writing 50 years ago, but during a period when the United States was already importing about 10% of its oil from the Middle East, and when its strategic and economic investments in the area were unimaginably huge, Berger was ensuring the centrality of his own position as Orientalist. For what he says, in effect, is that without people such as he, the Middle East would be neglected, and that without his mediating, interpretative role, the place would not be understood, partly because what little there is to understand is fairly peculiar, and partly because only the Orientalist can interpret the Orient being radically incapable of interpreting itself. The fact that Berger was not so much a classical Orientalist when he wrote, "He wasn't and isn't," as he was a professional sociologist, does not minimize the extent of his indebtedness to Orientalism and its ideas. Among those ideas is the specially legitimated antipathy towards and downgrading of the material forming the main basis of his study. So strong is this in Berger that it obscures the actualities before his eyes. And more impressively still, it makes it unnecessary for him to ask himself why, if the Middle East is not a center of great cultural achievement, he should recommend that anyone devote his life, as he has, to the study of its culture. Scholars, more than, say, doctors, study what they like and what interests them. Only an exaggerated sense of cultural duty drives a scholar to the study of what he does not think well of. Yet it is just such a sense of duty Orientalism has fostered, because for generations the culture at large put the Orientalist at the barricades, where in his professional work he confronted the East, its barbarities, its eccentricities, its unruliness, and held it at bay on behalf of the West. I mention Berger as an instance of the academic attitude towards the Islamic Orient, as an instance of how a learned perspective can support the caricatures propagated in the popular culture. Yet Berger stands also for the most current transformation overtaking Orientalism, its conversion from a fundamentally philological discipline and a vaguely general apprehension of the Orient into a social science specialty. No longer does an Orientalist try first to master the esoteric languages of the Orient. He begins instead as a trained social scientist and applies his science to the Orient, or anywhere else. This is the specifically American contribution to the history of Orientalism, and it can be dated roughly from the period immediately following World War II, when the United States found itself in the position recently vacated by Britain and France. The American experience of the Orient prior to that exceptional moment was limited. Cultural isolatos like Melville were interested in it. Cynics like Mark Twain visited and wrote about it. The American transcendentalists saw affinities between Indian thought and their own. A few theologians and biblical students studied the biblical Oriental languages. There were occasional diplomatic and military encounters with Barbary pirates and the like, the odd naval expedition to the Far Orient, and of course the ubiquitous missionary to the Orient, but there was no deeply invested tradition of Orientalism, and consequently in the United States, knowledge of the Orient never passed through the refining and reticulating and reconstructing processes whose beginning was in philological study that it went through in Europe. Furthermore, the imaginative investment was never made either, perhaps because the American frontier, the one that counted, was the westward one. Immediately after World War II, then, the Orient became not a broad Catholic issue as it had been for centuries in Europe, but an administrative one, a matter for policy. Enter the social scientist and the new expert, on whose somewhat narrower shoulders was to fall the mantle of Orientalism. In their turn, as we shall see, they made such changes in it that it became scarcely recognizable. In any event, the new Orientalists took over the attitudes of cultural hostility and kept them. One of the striking aspects of the new American social science attention to the Orient is its singular avoidance of literature. You can read through reams of expert writing on the modern Near East and never encounter a single reference to literature. What seemed to matter far more to the regional expert are facts, of which a literary text is perhaps a disturber. The net effect of this remarkable omission in modern American awareness of the Arab or Islamic Orient is to keep the region and its people conceptually emasculated, reduced to attitudes, trends, statistics, in short, dehumanized. Since an Arab poet or novelist, and there are many, writes of his experiences, of his values, of his humanity, however strange that may be, he effectively disrupts the various patterns, images, clichés, abstractions by which the Orient is represented. A literary text speaks more or less directly of a living reality. Its force is not that it is Arab or French or English. Its force is in the power and vitality of words that, to mix in Flaubert's metaphor from La Tentation de Saint-Antoine, tip the idols out of the Orientalists' arms and make them drop those great paralytic children, which are their ideas of the Orient, that attempt to pass for the Orient. The absence of literature and the relatively weak position of philology in contemporary American studies of the Near East are illustrations of a new eccentricity in Orientalism, where, indeed, my use of the word itself is anomalous. For there is very little in what academic experts on the Near East do now that resembles traditional Orientalism of the sort that ended with Gibb and Massignon. The main things that are reproduced are, as I said, a certain cultural hostility and a sense based not so much on philology as on expertise. Genealogically speaking, modern American Orientalism derives from such things as the Army language schools established during and after the war, sudden government and corporate interest in the non-Western world during the post-war period, Cold War competition with the Soviet Union, and a residual missionary attitude towards Orientals who are considered ripe for reform and re-education. The non-philological study of esoteric Oriental languages is useful for obvious rudimentary strategic reasons, but it is also useful for giving a cachet of authority, almost a mystique, to the expert who appears able to deal with hopelessly obscure material with first-hand skill. In the social science order of things, language study is a mere tool for higher aims, certainly not for reading literary texts. In 1958, for example, the Middle East Institute, a quasi-governmental body founded to oversee and sponsor research interest in the Middle East, produced a report on current research. The contribution, Present State of Arabic Studies in the United States, done, interestingly enough, by a professor of Hebrew, is prefaced by an epigraph announcing that no longer is knowledge of foreign languages, for instance, the sole province of the scholars in the humanities. It is a working tool of the engineer, the economist, the social scientist, and many other specialists. The whole report stresses the importance of Arabic to oil company executives, technicians, and military personnel. But the report's main talking point is this trio of sentences. Russian universities are now producing fluent Arabic speakers. Russia has realized the importance of appealing to men through their minds by using their own language. the United States need wait no longer in developing its foreign language program. Thus, Oriental languages are part of some policy objective, as to a certain extent they have always been, or part of a sustained propaganda effort. In both these aims, the study of Oriental languages becomes the instrument carrying out Harold Lasswell's theses about propaganda, in which what counts is not what people are or think, but what they can be made to be and think. The propagandist outlook, in fact, combines respect for individuality with indifference to formal democracy. The respect for individuality arises from the dependence of large-scale operations upon the support of the mass and upon experience with the variability of human preferences. This regard for men in the mass rests upon no democratic dogmatisms about men being the best judges of their own interests. The modern propagandist, like the modern psychologist, recognizes that men are often poor judges of their own interests, flitting from one alternative to the next without solid reason, or clinging timorously to the fragments of some mossy rock of ages. Calculating the prospect of securing a permanent change in habits and values involves much more than the estimation of the preferences of men in general. It means taking account of the tissue of relations in which men are webbed, searching for signs of preference which may reflect no deliberation, and directing a program towards a solution which fits in fact. With respect to those adjustments which do require mass action, the task of the propagandist is that of inventing goal symbols which serve the double function of facilitating adoption and adaptation. The symbols must induce acceptance spontaneously. It follows that the management ideal is control of a situation not by imposition, but by divination. The propagandist takes it for granted that the world is completely caused, but that it is only partly predictable. The acquired foreign language is therefore made part of a subtle assault upon populations, just as the study of a foreign region like the Orient is turned into a program for control by divination. Yet such programs must always have a liberal veneer, and usually this is left to scholars, men of goodwill, enthusiasts to attend to. The idea encouraged is that in studying Orientals, Muslims, or Arabs, we can get to know another people, their way of life and thought, and so on. To this end, it is always better to let them speak for themselves, to represent themselves, even though underlying this fiction stands Marx's phrase, with which Lasswell is in agreement, for Louis Napoleon. They cannot represent themselves, they must be represented. But only up to a point, and in a special way. In 1973, during the anxious days of the October Arab-Israeli War, the New York Times Magazine commissioned two articles, one representing the Israeli and one the Arab side of the conflict. The Israeli side was presented by an Israeli lawyer, the Arab side by an American former ambassador to an Arab country who had no formal training in Oriental studies. Lest we jump immediately to the simple conclusion that the Arabs were believed incapable of representing themselves, we would do well to remember that both Arabs and Jews in this instance were Semites, in the broad cultural designation I have been discussing, and that both were being made to be represented for a Western audience. It is worthwhile here to remember this passage from Proust, in which the sudden appearance of a Jew into an aristocratic salon is described as follows. The Romanians, the Egyptians, the Turks may hate the Jews, but in a French drawing-room the differences between those people are not so apparent, and an Israelite making his entry as though he were emerging from the heart of the desert, his body crouching like a hyena's, his neck thrust obliquely forward, spreading himself in proud salams, completely satisfies a certain taste for the Oriental. Un goût pour l'orientalisme. 2. Cultural Relations Policy. While it is true to say that the United States did not in fact become a world empire until the 20th century, it is also true that during the 19th century, the United States was concerned with the Orient in ways that prepared for its later overtly imperial concern. Leaving aside the campaigns against the Barbary pirates in 1801 and 1815, let us consider the founding of the American Oriental Society in 1842. At its first annual meeting in 1843, its president, John Pickering, made the very clear point that America proposed for itself the study of the Orient in order to follow the example of the imperial European powers. Pickering's message was that the framework of Oriental studies, then as now, was political, not simply scholarly. Note in the following summary how the lines of argument for Orientalism leave little room for doubt as to their intention. At the first annual meeting of the American Society in 1843, President Pickering began a remarkable sketch of the field it was proposed to cultivate by calling attention to the especially favorable circumstances of the time, the peace that reigned everywhere, the freer access to Oriental countries, and the greater facilities for communication. The earth seemed quiet in the days of Metternich and Louis Philippe. The Treaty of Nanking had opened Chinese ports. The screw propeller had been adopted in ocean-going vessels. Morse had completed his telegraph, and he had already suggested the laying of a transatlantic cable. The objects of the society were to cultivate learning in Asiatic, African and Polynesian language, and in everything concerning the Orient, to create a taste for Oriental studies in this country, to publish texts, translations, and communications, and to collect a library and cabinet. Most of the work has been done in the Asiatic field, and particularly in Sanskrit and the Semitic languages. Metternich, Louis Philippe, the Treaty of Nanking, the screw propeller, all suggest the imperial constellation facilitating Euro-American penetration of the Orient. This has never stopped. Even the legendary American missionaries to the Near East during the 19th and 20th centuries took their role as set not so much by God as by their God, their culture, and their destiny. The early missionary institutions, printing presses, schools, universities, hospitals, and the like, contributed, of course, to the area's well-being, but in their specifically imperial character and their support by the United States government, these institutions were no different from their French and British counterparts in the Orient. During the First World War, what was to become a major United States policy interest in Zionism and the colonization of Palestine played an estimable role in getting the United States into the war. British discussions prior to and after the Balfour Declaration, November 1917, reflect the seriousness with which the declaration was taken by the United States. During and after the Second World War, the escalation in United States interest in the Middle East was remarkable. Cairo, Tehran, and North Africa were important arenas of war, and in that setting, with the exploitation of its oil, strategic and human resources pioneered by Britain and France, the United States prepared for its new post-war imperial role. Not the least aspect of this role was a cultural relations policy, as it was defined by Mortimer Graves in 1950. Part of this policy was, he said, the attempt to acquire every significant publication in every important Near Eastern language published since 1900, an attempt which our Congress ought to recognize as a measure of our national security. For what was clearly at stake, Graves argued, to very receptive ears, by the way, was the need for much better American understanding of the forces which are contending with the American idea for acceptance by the Near East. The principal of these are, of course, communism and Islam. Out of such a concern, and as a contemporary adjunct to the more backward-looking American Oriental Society, was born the entire vast apparatus for research on the Middle East. the model, both in its frankly strategic attitude and in its sensitivity to public security and policy, not, as is often postured, to pure scholarship, was the Middle East Institute, founded May 1946 in Washington under the aegis of, if not entirely within or by,